This is the second half of the Nauvoo Expositor discussion. We now join the conversation already in progress.
Okay, Resolution 7, that the discontinuance and disprobate the attendance at houses of reveling and dancing, dram shops, and theaters, fairly believing they have a tendency to lead from paths of virtue and holiness to those of vice and debauchery.
Get off my lawn, you darn kids.
It's hard to know exactly what's behind this. You know, the only thing that came to my mind is that in the journals of, say, Brigham Young and some of those others, we know that after the temple was built, and they would go and do the endowment, and then they would oftentimes move all the stuff out of the temple, all the, you know, trees and veils and all that, and then they would dance until dawn in the temple. And Brigham Young, we know, was very into the theater. He was very into dancing. We don't necessarily have any indication that there was anything of a vile or unvirtuous nature going on there. But, you know, this was the sort of the Victorian time when a lot of people, well, it's pre-Victorian time, but still a lot of people look down on dancing. So that's the best I can tell. The dram shops, we know Joe Smith liked to hang out in Mosier's and have a good beer every once in a while. But I don't know exactly what they're talking about here.
Maybe he had a poor attitude towards Brigham.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Frankly, I know more about Brigham on that aspect than I know about Joseph. But, you know, Joseph liked to have a good time. So if there's the first six I was with, the seventh, I don't know. You know, I don't know what they're talking about.
But that's still a hit. That's still a hit, though.
Well, I mean, it goes with common feeling at the time. I think that many people would have found that. And I don't know that the fact that the brethren stayed and danced till dawn in the temple was widely known.
But you have to remember these resolutions are his sort of theses, right?
Yeah, so he's trying to reform the church.
We don't have to agree with the resolutions, because I would have had an issue with the ones about the laws of the land. It's just what he thinks, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
I wouldn't call any of these dishonest yet. You know, nothing here has been a lie.
Well, a lot of times when you deal with anti-Mormon stuff, a lot of it is personal attitude showing through, as opposed to a real problem.
Hell, Mike, when you deal with Mormon stuff, it's personal. I mean, isn't that what the apologists always tell us? That they're always speaking as men.
I agree. That argument can be totally used both sides.
A lot of it's a glass half full, glass half empty.
Or all empty.
The glass is just too darn big. All right.
Or broken apart, shattered.
Poisoned.
All right. Resolution number 8, that we look upon the pure and holy doctrine set forth in the scriptures of divine truth as being the immutable doctrines of salvation, and he who abideth in them shall be saved, and he who abideth not in them cannot enter in the kingdom of heaven. To me, this is another attack at what was mentioned before. We know that when Joseph and Brigham and those would approach young women to enter in polygamous relationships, they would promise them and their families guaranteed eternal life, spot on the dime for just entering into the relationship.
And
could you read this as one of the departure points for Mormons from Christianity? I mean, if this is a valid accusation, then is this a rejection of the atonement in a Christian sense?
It definitely now I think we have to be clear that the church I think the church has abandoned this doctrine, and probably did after polygamy went away. Probably before that, but yes, this is a very strange doctrine, and we don't know very much about it. They didn't talk about it very openly. It was probably always taught in secret. But I think you're right. They
just replaced this doctrine with the hoo-ha and stuff in the temple, right?
But you're trying to use this as a juxtaposition of Christianity, where oftentimes we take American Protestantism, where the linchpin of that is that you accept Jesus Christ, your own personal Savior, and then salvation is sort of guaranteed on a grace basis, where that is
grace and works is one thing, but, you know, works is sort of implying like you're earning the salvation. I can get that. What I don't get is something that's neither related to grace or works that's required, like you must be physically baptized, whether in life or in death. What does this have to do with works or grace? It's just
the ordinances?
Yeah.
That's what you're upset about?
No, I'm saying this would be an example of some it's works nor grace, but if it's still required for salvation, I feel like you're rejecting the atonement. So
no, Niall, it's not the same. The commandment to get baptized or something like that would just be a work.
But it required it's not a work. See, work is like doing good to earn it, to deserve it, to be worthy of it, right?
Well, you have to do that. You have to submit to the interview. I mean, you have to have repented. You know, if you're a convert, you have to quit smoking, quit drinking before you can. So those are all works, right?
But it's something bigger. It's not the works that matters. It's the empty ritual that's providing the salvation and not the atonement.
Well, that may be.
See, doing the right thing, not beating your neighbor up and taking his TV, is not a ritual. Getting baptized is a ritual.
I think this is a whole. We're heading off on a red herring here.
Yeah, I'm gonna side with Mike again. All right, let's go down to resolve number 9. That we consider the gathering in haste and by sacrifice to be contrary to the will of God, and that has been taught by Joseph Smith and others for the purpose of enabling them to sell property at most exorbitant prices, not regarding the welfare of the church. Okay, Mike brought this up. So the background is that Joseph Smith, a.k.a. the church, remember we said that they really were unseparable. Well, let's go way back. So the church buys Nauvoo, buys Commerce, Illinois, and it buys a lot of the half-breed tracts across the river. We get down the road, we find out the sale on the half-breed tracts was illegal, and there was a lot of property speculation and all that sort of stuff. Property speculation is the one thing that's constant in the church, right? They practice it in Kirtland, they practice it in Missouri, they practice it in Nauvoo, and it always blew up on them. But Joseph Smith controlled much of the property down in what they called the flats, which is down in the bottom part of town. And in the master plan, Joseph Smith wanted there to be a big downtown sort of business district up there. Up on the hill behind the temple, was referred to as the hill, there were others who owned property. And we talked a little bit about that before, where the laws owned property up there. Joseph Smith tried to encourage new immigrants to buy his tracts of land. Of course, all of these were at prices that were much higher than when they first acquired them, when they first dealt with them.
The swampland?
This is the swampland that had been drained. And this is where Joseph Smith was, and this is where a lot of the business district was. But you also have to understand that there wasn't a lot of hard currency. So this happened in Kirtland, this happened in Missouri. They didn't have any money. So they would trade notes of property, and the whole economy would be based on speculation on property. So I would buy this piece of land from Joseph Smith for $100. Then I'd sell it to Hiram for $1,000, and Hiram would sell it to Parley for $2,000. And meanwhile, we're all getting rich, but there's no money there. And then it collapses, just like it did in Kirtland, just like it did in Missouri. So the laws, as more and more immigrants came in, the actual, this is my take on it. Mike's probably going to take another take. There was a lot of people who wanted to live up there, and Joseph was saying, no, the Lord, Joseph Smith, and God wants you to buy the property down here in the flats. And he looked at the competition that he had with much of these guys who founded the Expositor as kind of stepping on his prophetic mantle.
Well, he was trying to get money to build up the city. I mean, that land was church land. So when you're buying church land, the money goes to the church.
Mike,
and the church
was
heavily in debt.
You say to build up the city or to build up the church. What was he going to use that money for that he was gaining through land speculation?
Well, they were heavily in debt. The church was
heavy in debt.
So yeah. Joseph Smith / the church was heavy in debt. So technically that was Joseph Smith's personal debt rolled into that as well.
Yeah, kind of.
So I don't see how you can say that he had this altruistic motive of you know, behind the purpose of land speculation, that he would use the profits from the speculation in order to do something altruistic. I mean, unless I'm misunderstanding what you're saying, are you saying that?
I'm saying they're trying to get the church out of debt and build a temple. And if it means selling land and telling him to hold off on his upper land until they get the debt of the church taken care of, then, you know, that's what William Law was upset about.
And I think Mike's probably right for the most part. I think Joseph tended to consider the church higher than his own thing. I think he thought that he could ride the coattails of that And he was looking for personal comfort. I mean, I am too, so I don't really blame him for that too much. You know, I want a nice house. Let's read number 10, because I think this sheds more light on it. Resolve 10, that notwithstanding our extensive acquaintance with the financial affairs of the church, we do not know of any property which in reality belongs to the church except the temple, and we therefore consider the injunction laid upon the saints compelling them to purchase property of the trustee and trust of the church is a deception practiced upon them. So here we've talked about this quite a bit, that the financial affairs of Joseph and the church were not separated. And I think the expositor authors are siding with Jim on this one, that they're accusing Joseph of enriching himself. And probably his mistake, if we follow Mike's reasoning, is that he didn't separate them. If he had, maybe they would have seen clearly that his motives were more pure.
Well, just to put in a little perspective on it, or a little different light, anybody that had received their endowment had promised that, you know, we promise in the temple that our money is the church's, our homes are the church's. And anybody that's would have been in the 12 or anything else, you know, all these things are supposed to be collectively for the kingdom of God. So for William Law to be fighting against this and saying bah humbug to whatever is him going against what he'd covenanted.
But William Law is saying that it does not go to the church. It goes to Joseph Smith. Therefore, that argument is invalid.
Would you consider Joseph to be wealthy and flashy?
Was he wealthy? Yeah.
I mean, the house they had in Nauvoo was the first house he'd ever had.
He He was strutting around in a uniform that he had purchased, and he basically had this air of pseudo affluency that was, you know, particular to the Western United States at the time. I think Joseph Smith, yes, he thought himself affluent. He thought he was the king of the world. You know, he had pretension of being this, you know, grand individual worthy of respect from all. So yeah, he had an attitude of that he was a well-to-do individual. And I think this land speculation was an attempt for him to actually attain that instead of just showing off as if he were.
Okay, Resolution 11, that we consider all secret societies and combinations under penalty, oaths, and obligations professing to be organized for religious purposes to be anti-Christian, hypocritical, and corrupt. So I already mentioned in the preamble that there were four such societies in Nauvoo. Of course,
no, that's all a lie.
Of course, there were the Masons, the Holy Order, which grew into the endowment, the Danites, had oaths, and then the Council of 50 had oaths. So obviously they're railing against any one of those four.
Now, on the Danites, that wasn't anything to do with Joseph. That was some whole other thing.
In this period, the Danites had morphed from what they were in Missouri, which was sort of a, I don't know, hit squad, to be more his personal bodyguard.
Goombas?
And whatever. Well, like, they'd hang around him, and their duties are ostensibly to protect him. But if he said, I need a blank, one of them would do that. They're sort of the Praetorian Guard at this point.
I know there are church people who claim that, Mike, and, you know, so you're not coming out of left field with that. But I think there's pretty good evidence that Joseph Smith was well aware of the Danites and was involved.
Well, aware of it, but he never authorized them. He never told them. I mean, this was somebody's own thing off on his own. This wasn't anything to do with the church or Joseph. This is some members that taken up their own thing.
Well, there's many who disagree with that. I mean, in sworn court affidavits who say they were ordered by Joseph Smith to do it. Samson of Ard, for one, who is their leader, said he was acting under the direction of Joseph Smith.
And you have to realize when Joseph was of knowledge of them, they had already gone too far, so it was very much in his interest to, you know, feign ignorance.
Well, I don't know what the things I studied about the Danites is they were their own thing off in left field, and it had nothing to do with Joseph.
And I would respectfully...
Why are you using the same argument that is used for the Mountain Meadows Massacre? I see a common theme in apologetics in that. I just wanted to comment on that common theme while I have the chance.
I think, Mike, that there's a lot of people who share your conviction, and I respectfully disagree, but I think that's probably a topic for another day. However, it is clear that at least those guys who, you know, who were Danites, Rockwell, Wild Bill Hickman, some of those guys, they were fully operating in Nauvoo. So whether or not they were still, but we know from their writings that they still considered themselves bound by those blood oaths they made in Missouri. And so I think there's still good argument that they were operative. And, you know, there's evidence they were operative even into Salt Lake City. As a matter of fact, there's been a creepy guy hanging around my yard lately.
So would there ever be a situation in the church where there could be a secret society, a secret combination that had oaths and obligations? Is there a situation where it would be Christian? Has there been any historical examples?
Well, Christianity is full of secret societies. His allegation that it's anti-Christian, I don't know that.
Yeah, that's what I'm struggling with, is the anti-Christian thing, because I think there's been lots of orders throughout the years. I mean, there's got to be a ton of them just within Catholicism.
Yeah, I think he's. Go ahead.
I think he's referring not to a doctrinal Christianity, but rather to the sense of Christianity of loving thy neighbor, being open and honest with people. So, like, if I punch someone in the nose, you could say action, but you couldn't say, well, does he reject Christ or blah, 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 like that.
Right, right.
And I think he's just riding on that 19th century anti-Masonic sentiment, which was really strong in the church in the early days, that there were a lot of people who were alarmed when the Masons took so many of the leadership into their ranks in 42 in Nauvoo, and I think he was probably one of them. It's just anti-Mason sentiment.
Yeah, I would agree. This is that. That's what it feels more like than saying there's just no role, and to be in that type of situation is an antichrist.
Okay, resolve number 12, that we will not acknowledge any man as king or lawgiver to the church, for Christ is our only king and lawgiver. Obviously, that's a reference to the anointing of Joseph Smith as king. And like I said, the language being anointed king over the house of Israel to reign forever. I think there's obviously a reference to this because, like I said, that's Masonic language, messianic language, and quite striking.
Well, just as a side note to that, I just wanted to mention that there was an analogous thing happened to the Moonies. The Reverend Sun Young Moon also crowned himself as the king of the world, and along the same lines as Joseph Smith. Just a little side note,
Mike.
Now, I was going to say, I can't remember who did a paper on it recently, but they discussed the formation of roles in the church as prophet, priest, and king. And what Joseph was doing is he wanted to make Hiram the prophet, and he was going to move on to being a king, and all members of the church are priests, and he was establishing, I don't even know the proper phrase to use for it, but it was part of that whole prophet, priest, king. He was stepping out of one role into another and trying to set others up for the other offices.
I think that's possible. It's speculative, but it also follows Masonic order to do the prophet, priest, and king thing. So it's possible. Who knows? We don't have access to, some of the things I told you one of the sources I used was D. Michael Quinn, and he had access to the minutes from the Council of 50, which the church has not granted anybody access to since Quinn for obvious reasons. So there's a lot of things that Quinn quotes out of those minutes that the rest of us are just left to say, well, we don't know. The church could release them, but they choose not to. So if were they to release those notes, we would probably have a much better idea of what Joseph Smith was thinking when he had himself crowned king. That's for you, Elder Jensen. All right.
I wish I had a link to that paper I had on it. There was a whole paper written up recently on the whole prophet, priest, king aspect.
Yeah, are you talking? It was in Sunstone like 3 years ago or so.
Yes.
Was it Don Bradley who wrote that one? I think it was
because he came on Shadesboard and offered the link to everybody, and you could go on and read the whole thing. It was really, really interesting.
Maybe we'll have to invite Don to come talk about it here.
Okay.
All right. Resolve 13. That we call upon the honest in heart in the church and throughout the world to vindicate the pure doctrines of Jesus Christ, whether set forth in the Bible, Book of Mormon, Book of Covenants. And we hereby withdraw the hand of fellowship from all those who practice or teach doctrines contrary to the above until they cease to do so and show works meet for repentance. And that was in their testimony that they had in this same document. It's interesting to note that they use the Book of Covenants here, separating it from the Doctrine Covenants. A lot of the early church leaders, like the Witnesses, John Whitmer, David Whitmer, Oliver Cowdery, those guys who left the church in 37, 38, a lot of their complaints were that the Joseph Smith had changed fundamentally what the church was set up to be. And I think this is a kind of a reference back to that, since they use the Book of Commandments. And just a suggestion saying, you know, the Book of Mormon rolled, and the early days of the church rolled out this whole theology, and Joseph Smith had completely almost contradicted every aspect of it by the time it was 44.
I'm trying to figure out what point he's trying to make here. And I would think if you're looking at it from, you know, a lot of his issues were with celestial marriage. You know, in the church, the baptism is the doctrine of salvation, or the ordinance or covenant of salvation. And for exaltation, you have to enter into celestial marriage. Now, and at this time, celestial marriage was polygamy. So he's saying to be exalted or to be brought up to the highest level of heaven, you have to enter into something beyond baptism. And I can see where his whole issue with the King Follett discourse and plurality and plural marriage, that would be the issue I think he's taking here, is that this is going beyond the covenant of salvation and the covenant of, he has issue with the covenant of exaltation.
I think that's a fair read, but you know, practically on the ground, you know, things like you have to know secret passwords to get into heaven, that the Book of Mormon was very much against secret societies, and here Nauvoo is replete with them. You know, that there were all these different changes that had been made, and it was going in a very, very different direction, and I think that a lot of people were uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, a lot of people left after the King Follett discourse. A lot of people left over plural marriage. You know, it's the expansion of doctrine, and really those doctrines make things clearer to me as far as what Christ is trying to help us with.
Well, and you say left.
Obviously.
I think that's a key point, because when they regrouped in Missouri in 38, when they rode the dissidents out of town, like the Mormons chased the dissidents out. And in Nauvoo, they couldn't do that. So there were people in as early as 42, 43 started having problems, but they just stayed. And that's what this represents, this thing that came to pass with the expositor. It was, there were more and more people. There were more and more dissidents. That's why Joseph Smith started becoming more militant, I think, because, you know, Mormons have been mistreated by outsiders. Let me make that absolutely clear. But Mormonism has always faced more problems from the insiders. And that's what Joseph Smith is having here, because the dissidents leave and cause all sorts of problems because they take the internal working knowledge of the church with them.
Proof of that would be the expositor itself, because what was the Warsaw, what was it called? The Warsaw paper, whatever it was called, has been anti-Mormon the whole time, and they weren't raiding that.
Right. Mike, did you have a thought?
No, I'm
okay. Resolve 14. That we hereby notify all those holding license to preach the gospel who know they are guilty of teaching the doctrines of other gods above the God of this creation, the plurality of wives, the unconditional sealing up against crimes, save the shedding of innocent blood, the spoiling of the Gentiles and all other doctrines, so-called, which are contrary to the laws of God, or to the laws of the country, to cease preaching and to come and make satisfaction and have their licenses renewed. Now, the only thing new they add here is the spoiling of the Gentiles. And I don't know that all of our listeners know this, but during the Missouri period, before the Battle of Crooked River or whatever it was, the the burning of the houses and the sacking of houses and taking spoils was happening on both sides. Mormon raiders were going and burning homes and taking things and putting them in the bishop's storehouse, as were the mobs. I mean, it was happening on both sides. So there was sort of this Danite directive to do that. I think some Mormons were always uncomfortable with the practice.
And this continued into the Salt Lake period during the Utah War.
Yes, I suppose. I don't know.
Well, that was Brigham's order at the time was don't kill anybody, but you can take all their stuff. That's how they dealt with the soldiers coming into the Utah Valley.
Well, of course, that's the easiest way to kill somebody who's out on the trail is take all their stuff.
Yeah, in the wintertime, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in essence, he was telling them to kill them. So.
Well, I mean, that's the Utah War is probably a topic for another day because, you know, there's a continuum between, you know, like personal violence, mob action, and then war. And terrorism probably fits somewhere along there. And it's really hard to – the Utah War more resembles a conventional war than, say, these things here. So anyway. Resolve 15, that in all our controversies in defense of truth and righteousness, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal but mighty through God to the pulling down of the strongholds of Satan, that our strifes are not against flesh, blood, nor bone, but against principalities and power, against spiritual wickedness in high places, and therefore we will not use carnal weapons save in our defense. So, pretty powerful
stuff. Our weapons are words, not the guns.
So the Nauvoo Expositor, 15 resolutions. Now, does anybody... Go ahead.
One thing that really rings through to me is the eloquence and the soul with the English language in the written form. As you read through here, it doesn't feel like a lot of other church material that you read from that era. Do you know if these have been modified over the years, or who was it that actually had the education to be able to pull this off?
Well, I think
the laws were very intelligent. They were doctors and they were businessmen. So that you get a lot of really good English from those educated types back in those days.
Okay.
And cool. I think you're emerging out from the fog of Sidney Rigdon when you have clear language.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks.
So published June 7th. The printing press was destroyed on the 10th. Does anybody have in front of them? I actually don't. What was the pronouncement, Joseph and the council? What was their justification?
They said
it was
wasn't it?
Yeah, Niall, go ahead.
It's actually a letter Smith justifying the city council's opinion to Governor Thomas Ford. He said, in the investigation, it appears evident to the council that the proprietors were a set of unprincipled men, lawless, debauchees, counterfeiters, bogus makers, gamblers, peace disturbers, and that the grand object of said proprietors was to destroy our constitutional rights and chartered privileges, to overthrow all good and wholesome regulations in society, to strengthen themselves against the municipality, to fortify themselves against the church of which I am a member, and destroy all our religious rights and privileges by libels, slanders, falsehoods, perjury, and sticking at no corruption to accomplish their hellish purposes, and that said paper of itself was libelous of the deepest dye and very injurious as a vehicle of action, tending to corrupt the morals and disturb the peace, tranquility, and happiness of the whole community, and especially that of Nauvoo.
Yeah, that sounds like it pissed Joseph off pretty good.
Well, at this point, hadn't the law set up their own church and William Law declared himself the prophet? And
can I cut in real quick? I have to ask you something, Mike, and this can go on the podcast or not. Now, we just went through, what was it, the 14 resolutions, right?
15.
And 15 resolutions. And would you agree that each of these resolutions were in letter and intent true?
I think it seems to me an issue of perspective.
It's binary.
but I mean, you didn't bring up any issues with any of these resolutions. Joseph Smith was preaching plurality of God. Yes. Did have secret societies. He did have plural wives, on and on and on. Every single one of these, would you agree, is true?
I'd have to go back and read through them again, but yeah, I didn't have any. I would have said something if I thought it was an outright lie.
Okay, now, when Joseph Smith said that everything in this paper, these very resolutions, were, quote, libelous at the deepest dye, and very injurious as a vehicle of defamation, you know, he's saying that it's full of, quote, libels, slanders, falsehoods, perjury, and Joseph would have known that every one of these things were true, correct?
Well, I haven't read through the rest of the expositor. I mean, we're looking at one issue here.
These points, Joseph Smith, this is the main idea, the main thrust of the paper. These are the most important things that they made a list. They had people sign it. This is the whole of the paper. Joseph Smith knew these were true, correct? You also know these are true, correct?
Right.
Joseph Smith, right here in the little selection I just read, that he wrote to the Governor Thomas Ford, is Joseph Smith blatantly, clearly, flagrantly lying.
John,
you cannot.
John, in the rest of the paper, are there libels and slanders?
Okay, I haven't read
through the whole thing.
Not that I can find.
From just what we see here, and if you can find something on the rest of the paper, you know, bring it up. You have something so rare in history that you find. It's put in a frame. It's got little filigrees on the frame. It's got arrows pointing to it. You agree with the precepts. Joseph Smith agreed with the precepts. The historical fact is not disputed by either the critics or the apologists. What do you say to that?
The issue here is he's turning people's attitudes and changing, and it's the attitude and the, I don't know of another word proper, but. It's a viewpoint that he's putting forth, that he's putting a negative spin on good things.
I'll take a stab at being an apologist here. It's acknowledged that Joseph Smith lied on multiple occasions. I mean, you can read that in a Rough Stone Rolling. But God commanded them to lie. They were lying for the Lord, that it was okay. The doctrines were so precious, so sacred. And the powers of the devil wanted them to be exposed in a light that was not the way they should be, because they took deep understanding to understand these deep doctrines. So Joseph Smith was authorized to lie. I think that'd be the only defense you'd have.
It's similar to the people that had issue with – look in Christ's day when he introduced the sacrament. Or to come to you and say the Christians are drinking blood and eating human flesh, it's not a lie. But you're putting a negative spin on things.
This is not a metaphor, what we just talked about. Would you agree with what John said? Mike, do you agree with John's spin?
you don't necessarily have to add to that. We're not here to like skewer Mike on the spit or anything, but you know, the one thing I have to point out with what you read, Niall, is it's funny that in the same letter that he calls people like gamblers and liars, he accuses them of libel. But that's neither here nor there. All right. So, Joseph Smith.
I'd go back to really quickly what Bushman talks about on this thing. I think what they basically do, and we started out the podcast with this was Joseph's big mistakes. I mean, they could have chosen as a city council with him as the mayor to have done nothing, or they could have done the opposite, which is what they did, which is something, and took it not only to just destroying the papers and the printed part, but they destroyed the press and the building and everything like that. It'd be interesting for us to explore that mistake and what would have happened if they had gone the other way and just done nothing.
Well, I think that we need to point out that we're focusing on the expositor. Mike keeps coming up with the things like they were talking about a schism church. That's true. There were secret meetings going on, and you can read about them in church history where there were spies for both sides, and everybody was living together in Nauvoo, but no one knew what direction it was going to go. It was going to blow up, and this was just the match to the tinder, right? So
yeah, Law actually was paying somebody that was on, I don't know if it was another member of the 12 or somebody, as a spy for him once he'd been booted out.
Yeah, and the church had spies too. There were spies backwards and forwards.
Right.
I think what we can gather from the Nauvoo Expositor is that Nauvoo was one big giant soap opera. Everybody was sleeping together, at least the powerful people. There were backroom deals. There was money exchanged that was essentially, you know, some really shady deals going on. You know, I think that's what we can take away from the Nauvoo Expositor is that there was something wrong with Nauvoo. There was at its core, there was something deeply wrong with this community.
Well, I think that there was a spirit of speculation, not only financial speculation, which would eventually collapse. I mean, you can't keep creating wealth just by increasing property values. I mean, we know that more than anybody right now. We just lived through it. You can't just keep creating wealth that way. And also, there was that sort of speculative theology where Joseph Smith kept bringing people in by saying, well, have you heard the latest thing? You know, here's the, you're going to be in on the next big thing. And that can't go on forever either. Before, because you're creating this theology or this church structure of an inside group and an outside group, and you keep getting secret circles on top of secret circles on top of secret circles. The problem is, once somebody bolts, the whole thing starts to unravel and it starts to come apart. And that's I just don't think it was sustainable. We talked in the beginning about, you know, Joseph dying. And the survival of the church after this thing, you know, there's a speculative thing. If Joseph had survived, I don't think the church would have survived. I think his dying sealed it up because it solidified it in time and kept him from adding new things to it. You know, I don't think they would have made it if he had kept on living. He probably would have been locked in a prison in Missouri.
It certainly would have burned out. Yeah, it certainly would have fizzled out because, I mean, like I said in the beginning, this was heading somewhere, and you know the Nauvoo Expositor was more of a symptom than the cause of the problem.
Well, no, the church wouldn't have burned out. He'd already given all the authority to the 12 and tried to set up a new prophet, so it would continue on without him.
You can't have a personality cult without a personality. The church would have collapsed.
That's what Joseph had been doing it the whole last few years was. Giving his authority to others and expanding, saying the 12 has all the authority I had. Now I'm stepping back. I want Hiram to be the prophet. I'm stepping back. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of drama, but look, he had all, how many people were in Nauvoo at the time, and he built it up in 5 years. I mean, there was a lot going on, but he was also trying to expand doctrine and bring everybody to where he was. The whole point of the church is to get us to where the prophet is. I mean, Moses tried to do it with the children of Israel. Everybody come up the mountain. Joseph's trying to do that same thing in Nauvoo. Everybody come up to the temple and have the same experiences I had and do what I'm doing. And he'd done that already with the 12. That's why the church was able to continue after his death.
All right.
Then why was there so much infighting? I'm sorry, we're dragging this point on.
Because we're human. Because we're people. Same reason they had drama with Moses.
Mike. There was so much infighting as who was going to be the prophet. There was so many backdoor deals and poisonings and people knocking each other off to get to the top of the church. What you're saying is that this was a clear pattern Joseph Smith had passed on, you know, the authority. But when Joseph died, the shit hit the fan, and everybody thought that they were going to be the next prophet.
Because all the apostles were out of town. Once the apostles all came back to town, things calmed down.
No,
everybody said Brigham's the prophet.
No, Brigham said that he was the prophet. Everybody was
sustained.
By a group of people. The thing is that I'm getting at is that everybody thought that they were going to be the prophet. There was no clear. The only reason that you believe that Brigham Young was the de facto prophet is because that's how it played out in history. If Sidney Rigdon, you know, for some godforsaken reason, would have stepped up and it would have been sustained by the people, you would have had the same story in Sidney Rigdon's place.
No, you know, Joseph Smith had the meeting of the last charge where he had all of them together. He took them all through every doctrine he'd ever taught. And said, I give you all the authority, the chief apostle is the chief apostle, and you have all have my authority. You are one with me in authority.
That's true. But
there a prophet on every single holster of Naboo.
Mike, what you say is true, but do you know where that happened? I'll tell you. It happened in a meeting.
Was it above the red store?
It happened in a meeting of the Council of the 50. So.
Yeah, and it wasn't until sometime after the death that Brigham Young finally figured out that the keys had been passed down. Brigham didn't expect it to be right away that back in the quorum of the first presidency, or in the Council of 50 or Council of 12, he really wondered at first whether the keys had died with Joseph. And so it wasn't until he figured this out, and I think there had to be some figuring out and him trying to figure out politically whether he could make a run for the presidency. Well, you know what I mean.
Okay. Well, who had the diary account of Joseph, leaping like a schoolboy led out to play, and he says, I've done it, I've removed them from my shoulders, and they all have it now. Who had that diary entry?
Well, I do know that there were pronouncements like that earlier where Joseph had said, you know, I've now given the brethren everything they need. And, you know, he had done that in the 1830s. So, but you make excellent points, Mike. And I think the whole succession crisis is probably a topic for a whole nother day. There's one last thing I want to sort of bring up and get your all thoughts on. Of course, the biggest irony of this is on July 20th, 1833, in Independence, Missouri, a mob came in and kicked off all the problems Mormonism had by destroying the printing press that they were currently printing the Evening and Morning Star and the Book of Commandments on. Surely the irony of Joseph's actions had to sink in. I mean, all the bad parts started. You know, the trouble of Mormonism started with the destruction of a printing press.
I know what you're saying, and you know I'm familiar with the history of the 1833, you know, the destruction of those presses. But really, when it comes down to it, and this is, you know, just basic human psychology in this type of situation, they were in the right when they destroyed, or they felt that they were in the right when they destroyed the Expositor, but they were harmed and slighted when the Millennial Star Press was destroyed. I think that's how they perceived it. You know, they were in the right. You know, it's cool when they do it. It's not cool when it's done to them, you know, because because God tells them what to do.
Yes, I just can't help noticing the cosmic irony that the real trouble in Joseph's life was bookended by two printing presses being destroyed.
Well, the one was a mob and the other was a legal action.
Mike, the legal action, the mob too.
I'd like to get into the legal action aspect in the apologetic hot air that's been coming out lately about that.
Mike, do you think if somebody puts a badge and a hat on, what they do is any less violent or wrong?
He had a council put together. They spent all day discussing the matter, and it took
a vote.
Do you think if
blowhards get together and yap and then put on badges and costumes and hats, what their actions are any less violent or wrong?
Wait a minute. You're describing mob rule, Niall.
Oh, am I? I'm sorry.
I think you are, yeah.
I don't think there's much difference except for the uniforms.
It's getting pretty thick in here, but
it's just a thing with me. You could totally not put this in, but it's just a thing with me when people say, "Oh, but it was legal." Like that changes the nature of the action in any way.
I agree with you, Niall, in that there is some like pedantic sort of argument about whether it was legal or not, and what would have happened when it court. Now, I know Oakes wrote a big, didn't he write his thesis on it or something like that?
Yeah.
And to me, it's fundamentally un-American, you know. There's something fundamentally wrong about it. And whether it was legal or not, I just wouldn't want to be on the page of trying to defend it. There's something that just seems so wrong about it. And I think you can still say, I think Joseph was a prophet and the church was true, but man, this was a big mistake.
I don't agree with that, but yeah. I see your point.
So let's try to think of a justifiable reason for this happening. Mike, why don't you start?
What do you mean? Justified reason for tearing down
the expositor? Why is justified? Why are these actions justified? Why is it justified to destroy someone's property just because they are printing truths, true facts about somebody that is uncomfortable? Why should that not be permitted? Why was that a correct, justifiable, moral action?
Well, at the time, Nauvoo was a tinderbox, like you stated. There's a lot of drama going on. There's arrest warrants coming every hour. And this was something that was stirring up more trouble and creating more mob mentality.
More trouble for who?
Wait. And it's not stirring it up because the tensions were created by Joseph.
That's a viewpoint. And this is another thing, changing people's viewpoints and put bad attitude, bad spin on things. And so it was torn down to keep the mob attitude down.
Do you think it worked?
No, I don't. What you're saying is that you can take a mob down, that you can take the expositor down with another mob, and that is justified.
It wasn't a mob. It was a legal action. It was the local authorities.
I think we've thoroughly discussed that and established that it was a mob rule that was taking place at the time. I don't know.
Do you want us to list the number of atrocities that are legal?
I don't know if you can call what they did as a mob. I mean,
yeah, I agree. I don't think it's a mob either. I think it's like in a lot of places around the country, in their city council, local city councils, if they see a danger or something that they see as a threat to the way of life or the peace in their community, will take action. It's probably illegal. I mean, there's examples in the news every day.
How is that fundamentally different than a mob, other than you have the color of law?
Well, because you have the color of law. I mean,
well, that doesn't change any. That doesn't
you
change
have,
anything.
The law can be illegal. Their actions are illegal. They can be found guilty by a higher up court or a higher up community.
But that doesn't change.
Structure.
So I think it was but done.
It's not a mob mentality.
It was done in cold blood.
It's absolutely a mob mentality. It's just the people doing it are different people doing
it. Right. I mean, they weren't all exercised. It was done in cold blood, meaning that they knew what they were doing. It was done by the Nauvoo police. So it resembles mob craft or whatever. And you have to remember also that this sort of action was very common. I said the action was un-American, but in essence, it's truly American. In the same way, lynchings are American. I mean, it's common for people to take action in their own hands. Now, if the people had just risen up against the newspaper and thrown it out, I would have called that a mob. But it was directed from the Nauvoo Council.
But you know, you get the people with the power dressing up in a costume, and then magically, it's not a mob.
No, for those who want to understand now,
the same violence is there.
So, from a community leader's perspective, how does this differ than any community in the country or the world today going against a local crack house and sending in the police to root everybody out, and then they give the fire department the opportunity to go down, set the thing on fire, and you know, watch it burn.
Well, I'll tell you why it's different. Because of the fundamental differences between those two actions. Printing a newspaper that, you know, is not liable, is not operating and doing anything illegal versus selling crack rock, you know, I think are two different
things. In their minds, I think it was the same. And I think it's demonstrated with the fact that they did come out and say it is libelous. Now, I totally agree with you guys that their paranoia was misplaced, but in their paranoia, they came up and said, "Let's go with these assumptions. Let's say that they're libelous, they're slanderous, they're going to cause us great distress, they're going to cause all kinds of problems. What can we do about it?" And then they probably brainstormed five or six different things that they could do, and they came up with the worst one possible. But I think in their minds, they probably said, this is a bad thing. It's the crack house of Nauvoo, and we need to take it out.
Well, to extend your metaphor, it would be the crack house of Nauvoo if they were all the crack dealers, right? because they were, the Nauvoo Council was the 12 and the other insiders who were practicing polygamy. They knew it was, they knew what was going on was true. And I think I would have been with them. I would have been fully on board with what they did if they'd boarded the thing up and, you know, put a quarantine on it. But they destroyed the press. That's where they crossed the line.
That's right. They should have just gone in and taken the newspaper itself, the paper part of it. They would have had legal precedence to do something like that. Where they definitely crossed the line is taking every all the press out of the basement, scattering the type. And then they torched the building too, right?
I'm not sure.
No, they didn't do that. But okay, what they should have done was the moral thing. And it's to respect another human being's ownership of himself and his property. That's what they should have done. If they don't want to buy his paper.
I don't think anybody's arguing with you, Niall.
Well,
you said,
oh, it would have been, you know, acceptable for them to go board up.
No, they had Fiverr's options that they could have done, and they chose the wrong one. But I think in their mind, they chose the right one, and they compared it to this crack house analogy and said it was a bad thing to do. I'm not pushing that as the best solution, but I think that's what they were thinking.
Well, then is the mob excused for the actions they take because they're going to think they're doing the right things as well?
Mobs probably always think they're doing the right thing for some good reason.
So why would that be any different for the government? What's magical about the people in the government?
I think we're going down a rabbit hole. All right. So I think we've I feel used and abused.
Mike should feel used and abused.
No.
Mike, I commend your – I think these are one of the reasons we focused in on this. I think these are really difficult things to defend, and I think you have a lot of decisions being made in the heat of the battle. We have the privilege of being able to read through journals and books and thoughts and all sorts of material that, you know, we can process these sort of questions as to, you know – I think some things like were the Higbees really connected to the brothel? I think those questions are up in the air, and you have to think of the way that rumors and innuendo and all that goes. That it's kind of hard for us to sit from, you know, the perspective of 180 years later and make the calls when we have all sort of information they didn't have. So, you know, they were going off their sort of frontier attitudes with the knowledge they had and making what we can easily call poor decisions. That of course led to the death of Hiram and Joseph. But, you know, I guess that you have to cut them some slack in that it's not always easy in the heat of battle to make the right call.
Yeah, this should have gone with the first choice of finding them for each slander.
Yeah, obviously they should have tried something different. But, you know, I think Joseph was really – I think he was really scared. I think a lot of insiders were turning against him. I think there's pretty good evidence that Emma had turned against him, and that just what he was doing was not sustainable. And, you know, I actually see some evidence that he might have been cracking. The idea that he was running for president, that he was sending the petition off to Congress to make a law that anybody who tries to hamper Joseph Smith goes to jail for 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of shtick that that Jim Jones was pulling at the end of his, the end of his reign.
And
seriously, I mean, think about it. I mean, this guy was going nuts. You know, he was on one giant power trip, and there wasn't going to be an end result of this other than, you know, total burnout.
Well, and you have to remember that it wasn't too many weeks before he died when he bragged that no one, including Jesus, could keep a church together, but he had done it. Yeah, there was a lot of bravado on the part of this man.
Keeping part of a lot of the power trip, or, as you say it, like running for president was to defend the people from the mobs.
Of course, it was.
He couldn't get federal help or an army to help stand against what was coming, so he's trying to do it on his own.
I think Joseph Smith would have sold every single Mormon down the river and for a candy bar if it would have meant that he would have gained more power.
I disagree with that. I think he
would have, but he would have found a cool way to rationalize it.
So what do you guys think about the whole argument that we're willing to give him a lot of slack for the mistakes he made because he was a new he didn't have anybody to look for advice. He didn't have a first timer. I mean, Brigham Young made mistakes, but he'd had somebody to look to. And so he made fewer mistakes than Joseph. And then they got fewer and fewer mistakes made, and they got older and they got more gray hairs and stuff like that. I mean, cause that seems to be another apologist tactic that's taken on a lot of these early things, is that he was just a young guy and he had nobody to really teach him how to do some of these things.
My response.
Go ahead. I think you're going
to
say it, John.
My response would be, this is the man who communes with Jehovah. He's the one who claims to have talked to Moses and to talk to Paul and to talk to Elijah and talk to Elias, that he's been visited by angels, and that he can, at the turn of a beat, get a personal revelation for whoever's coming to him, whoever's opposing him. So I think it's a far stretch to say the single most important man since the Savior just didn't have a good tutor.
Had the best tutors.
Mike, what do you think? Well, why would somebody with great tutors and the best tutors make so many mistakes in the latter half of his if you want to call it ministry, of his life? Because that's, I mean, he pulled some really stupid things.
I don't see it that way. The Kirtland Safety Society was a bad call. He'd already been told by God that he wouldn't be blessed in material things.
Even the decision to go destroy the expositor, if he was directly in commune, wouldn't he have prayed about it sometime during that city council meeting and said, hey guys, we better pray about this and get, I mean, like John just said, if somebody can get a revelation right from the get-go about sending somebody on a mission and it comes directly from God, why couldn't there have been why wasn't there DNC 196 and saying, thou shalt go knock down the expositor and spread its type? And
The expositor aside, he was going to be killed one way or another unless he had headed out to go found Salt Lake like he had intended to go. So he was going to get killed one way or the other as long as he stayed in Nauvoo.
All right, guys. I'm sure we could go on about this all night. And I think, if anything, like I said in the beginning, there's just so many avenues of what was happening here. And it's really even just hard to understand and piece it all together. I think what we've tried to do here is sort of give some of the context, some of the aftermath, and some of what the Nauvoo Expositor says. I think I will leave it to the listener to decide if the Nauvoo Expositor was what it says it is. Of course, we only covered part of the text. I invite everybody to go out and read it. We'll put a link up on our website to the original text of the Nauvoo Expositor. And like always, the conversation continues at mormonexpression.com. And you can call our number as soon as I find it here. It's on the Mormon Expression homepage. And you all need to get calling that number. It's 801-906-6722. So it's like beep, erp, 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 like that.